running mate J.D. Vance later today in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Trump's first campaign rally since his assassination attempt.
A source with knowledge of the investigation telling ABC News about the searches found on the gunman's phone. The date of Trump's rally, major depressive disorder, the Democratic National Convention, and bomb making. Images of FBI Director Christopher Wray, Attorney General Merrick Garland, and other public figures found on the phone as well.
ABC's Phil Lipoff. Meantime, there's mounting pressure on President Biden, facing growing calls to drop out of the race from fellow Democrats, donors, and others who don't think he's up to the fight. Sources tell ABC News Biden is now open to discussions over dropping out. And chaos and frustration at airports worldwide after Friday's massive cybersecurity outage caused by a software glitch from the global IT company CrowdStrike. Check your airline. Travel is still a mess. This is ABC. Churchill Downs has lifted its extended suspension of Bob Baffert more than 3 years after a failed drug test of the 2021 Kentucky Derby winner, Medina Spirit.
Ending the Baffert banishment allows the Hall of Fame trainer to resume racing his horses at the historic Louisville track and partner facilities. Baffert issued a statement in which he took responsibility for Medina Spirit's failed drug test. Kentucky racing stewards disqualified the horse the winter after the 2021 race. Churchill Downs elevated runner-up Mandaloon to Derby winner. The track noted that Baffert completed the penalty and promised to comply from now on.
ABC's Chuck Sievertson. It's been a good quarter for Netflix. Not only did the streaming service get a new logo, it also attracted more subscribers, 8 million more between April and June. That's a 37% increase over the same time last year. The uptick partly the result of Netflix cracking down on sharing passwords. Netflix currently has 278 million subscribers. I'm Derek Dennis, ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
This is a special announcement from Civic Media. Civic Media believes that violence has no place in the political process and stands in stark opposition to the principles of democracy. It stifles constructive dialogue, compromises the integrity of democratic institutions, and threatens the safety of individuals and communities. Democracy thrives on peaceful discourse, mutual respect, and adherence to the rule of law. It's crucial to engage with differing viewpoints respectfully and to avoid the temptation to vilify political opposition. Such vilification only deepens divisions and hampers the collaborative spirit necessary for effective governance. We, both individuals and media organizations, must reaffirm our commitment to the principles of democracy by fostering an environment where ideas can be exchanged peacefully and constructively. By doing so, we allow for a just, inclusive, and democratic society for all.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Hundreds of people on death row have now been exonerated over the last 50 years, and many more have been executed, even though they're innocent. Here's Will Waukee.
It's being called a historic milestone. 200 people have been exonerated after being sentenced to death since 1973. The exonerees were wrongfully convicted because of misconduct from government officials or other factors, and then set free after being behind bars, sometimes for decades. Robin Marr with the Death Penalty Information Center says cases like this have been devastating, not just for individual families, but for the nation.
Communities really lose confidence in the integrity of the legal system and its ability to respond appropriately and keep them safe.
Half of the public now believes the U.S. unfairly applies the death penalty, according to the latest polling, but a majority of Americans still favor death sentences for those convicted of murder. Nationwide, Marr says far more than 200 people have likely been wrongfully convicted and sentenced to death, in part because of challenges with the legal appeal process.
Once someone is convicted and sent to prison, that burden then shifts to them to prove that they're innocent. And that's very difficult to do without a good lawyer. And it's also very difficult to do because of the operation of the law.
The Death Penalty Information Center says two-thirds of those exonerated have been people of color. President Joe Biden campaigned on abolishing the federal death penalty, but his administration has taken few steps to do so. I'm Will Waukee, West Virginia News Service, Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
More news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Northern Wisconsin weather. I'm Corey Hartman. For today, a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Otherwise, mostly cloudy with highs in the upper 70s. For tonight, slight chance of a storm that comes to an end. We'll have mostly cloudy skies and a low around 55. Sunshine for Sunday with a high around 78.
It's 64 at our studios.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I'm live from Madison and welcome hilarious comedian Pat McGann and singer-songwriter Marta Hansen joins the show and performs live in studio.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights 7 till 9.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
Welcome to this, our weekly weekend-venued broadcast. My name is Jim Santel, and yes, I am your host both this hour and next hour as well for Amicus, a law review here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media statewide throughout the state of Wisconsin and certainly beyond as well. Delighted, honored to have you with me this weekend for this, our Amicus presentation, as we do every weekend, focusing upon law, justice, the delivery of justice in America and beyond in many occasions. Including today, we take our name, as always, our adopted commission from the notion of reviewing, analyzing, deliberating, considering some of the recent news of our times in those all-important areas of law and government and justice in America in particular. Amicus, as you know, a legal term. It's derived from the Latin. It means to describe a friend, ami, an individual, an organization that assists somehow in some understanding, some appreciation, some assessment of the relevant issues or questions that are before our state, our nation, and in many instances, our world as well. Some issues that need resolution, addressing, and some dispositive treatment, if you will, by a court, a jury, some other entity, even sometimes an individual that is wrestling with some particular issue of challenge and importance for our community. As we do every weekend, we are pursuant to that legal term and, yes, that commission. We are inviting your involvement, your discussion with us on those issues that we are going to be taking up this weekend. You do that by one of two ways, but you can call in and speak to Max or me. Max, my wonderful producer here in the studios of Civic Media, can call in at 844-967-2789. That phone number once again is 844-967-2789. Or we'll also take a note from you. You can drop something and Max and I will take a look at it in the Civic Media app. Engage in our conversation on the syllabus topics of this weekend. Today, as in the past, focusing a lot upon justice and courts. In particular, in our first hour, we're going to be doing something of a transition from our previous broadcasts of previous weekends, focusing especially upon the United States Supreme Court, talking as we have in past weeks about those 60 or so cases, now a part of history in America, including some major decisions having to do with the immunities attended upon a president of the United States of America, and also the ways in which our government works under this newly revised process established by the Supreme Court, getting rid of Chevron deference, a new relationship between agencies and courts in one of those cases, establishing a huge amount, I would argue even an unconstitutional amount of power vested in the executive branch, and in the other case, a huge amount, arguably inordinate to the Constitution as well, a great deal of power vested in the judiciary. Both of those cases join about 50 or so other matters that we've likewise described here on our broadcast station. Although we are in this period transitioning to our regular rule of law analysis, many things going on just this past week in our state, in America, and throughout the world, we necessarily have, as I indicated, a transition from those focuses upon the Supreme Court cases to a specific thing that happened in one of those cases and having to do with the prosecution of a former president. His name is Donald Trump, in the Southern District of Florida. So we're going to begin our syllabus, our amicus analysis this weekend by focusing upon this major decision. One of the big news stories of this past week in the area of rule of law, in which Judge Eileen Cannon, she's a federal district court judge. She is in the Southern District of Florida. That's where this documents prosecution, this documents case alleging that Donald Trump, just as he was leaving and since the time of his departure from the White House, took with him, retained, used various documents, also engaged in conspiracy to avoid and obstruct justice in an attempt to identify those documents and to get them back into the right hands. All those allegations in a complaint, in an indictment that has for about a year been pending in front of Eileen Cannon in that Southern District of Florida jurisdiction. Just this past week, major news story, Eileen Cannon dismisses the case outright, makes it very clear this case is done. She does so on the basis that the special counsel, Jack Smith, does not have the authority to prosecute this case. We're going to unpack that notion that does indeed come from one of the concurrences in the Supreme Court decision of a couple of weeks ago, finding that the president is immune, either completely immune or presumptively immune from prosecution under our federal criminal code. We're going to talk about the genesis, the basis for Judge Eileen Cannon's dismissal and what this means for the future. What are the options that are now before the special counsel? What has he done already in the wake of that dismissal? What does it mean for the future of that case? We're going to chat about all of that, going to dive deep into the bases for her decision and also the ways in which it runs afoul of virtually decades of decisions in this area that support exactly this kind of prosecution. We're going to talk all about that, invoking not only recent case law, but also the traditions of our United States Supreme Court. Then, in a continuing focus on the Supreme Court, we're going to be talking about another major news story of just this past week, indicating that along the way, the President of the United States of America has had his attention focused upon the Supreme Court. And just this past week, the president indicated that he has got some plans. He has got a package of proposals, some of them legislative, some of those related to changes, proposed changes in the Constitution of the United States of America, to address some of the challenges, problems, issues that he and many of the rest of us in America have identified when it comes to the administration of justice in and through our United States Supreme Court. We're going to talk about what Joe Biden may in fact be announcing in the relatively near future, what he hinted at this past week. What are the dimensions of that? What does it mean? And what does it say? What does it not say about what the president is planning to do, at least proposed to do, when it comes to the engagement of the people of the United States of America with our United States Supreme Court? And finally, as promised last week, we give you a little bit of a sampling of what the Supreme Court has already done in terms of identifying cases. Yes, that's right. It's not too soon to begin to talk about the next term of the United States Supreme Court. That begins, of course, in early October of this year. Not that far off. The Supreme Court has already identified something in excess of 20 cases already on its docket for this coming term, cases it will be entertaining through oral arguments, as we've talked before, memorandums, briefs filed by the parties, and ultimately, at or about this time again, next year, the United States Supreme Court issuing decisions on that next batch of cases, that next set of cases now being a part of its docket. Again, before the United States Supreme Court, we'll give you some sense about six new cases added to that list as a part of the Supreme Court's review coming up in the coming year or so. Of course, we'll continue to monitor and report and analyze the oral arguments on those cases as well. All of that coming up in our first hour here on Amicus, a Law Review. We've got a important second hour as well. It includes a lot of foreign aspects, a lot of overseas things. Yes, rule of law does not stop at our border. And we know that there are an awful lot of things going on in our federal and state courts that have implications overseas. And likewise, a lot of things going on overseas that have implications for our nation and our state. We're going to talk about some of those countries, and they include Egypt and South Korea and Israel and Russia. And I suspect you probably know what the news stories are that generate our focus on those four different nations. We've got the recent conviction of sitting Senator Robert Menendez for violations of the federal criminal code when it comes to corruption and other events. We're going to talk about that particular prosecution and what we can take away from not only the substance of what he was convicted of, but his reaction to that conviction, offering to you today that it is an example of how defendants can and should respond to the processes of our criminal justice system, as opposed to the ways in which our former president has responded in attacking the very notions about how we do criminal justice. We're going to talk about the Menendez conviction and the judgment there coming up. We're going to talk also about the decision by the United States Department of Justice to charge a former CIA analyst with crimes, again, against the federal criminal code, coming in connection with her association, longstanding, both academic and official, but with South Korea. We're going to talk all about that, what that means, in terms of what the Department of Justice is doing there. We are necessarily going to talk as well about a major decision issued by the International Court just this past week, the International Court making some determinations, some findings about the occupation and the settlements in the West Bank in Israel. What does that mean? What did the International Court say this past week about the West Bank settlements and the West Bank possession of that territory by the State of Israel? We'll talk about the reaction by the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in that nation. And we'll talk about the rule of law implications for that as well. And finally, in comparison to much, some, all of that, we're going to focus upon this major prosecution and the sentence imposed upon this Wall Street Journal reporter who's been in the custody, the control of the Russian government. He was sentenced just this past week by a Russian judge to 16 years in a penal colony in Russia. We're going to talk about what that means. We're going to talk about the distinctions between the way the Russians do things and the way we do things. We're going to talk about due process, substantive and procedural, and the ways in which we can, in the midst of the imperfect nature of much of what we do in America, nonetheless, the brightest, wonderful, most wonderful country on the face of the planet that does indeed aspire and in many ways on a daily basis, in fact, achieves justice in the courts of America. We're going to contrast that, do some comparative justice when it comes to the ways in which this particular defendant has been treated in the Russian courts. All of that coming up on this hour and next hour here on Amicus, a Law Review.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
Few Wisconsin events bring 600,000 people together from 80 different countries, but it happens every summer in Oshkosh.
Oshkosh has become synonymous with the world of flight and with EAA.
Dick Napinski's worked with EAA Air Venture for more than 30 years and knows its history. Do you? Where did EAA start? Wausau? La Crosse or Milwaukee? The answer coming up. The fly-in is spread across 1,600 acres with more than 10,000 airplanes. It brings a big boost to the economy, too.
It's $170 million of economic impact and more than $110 million of direct spending.
So where did EAA start? Milwaukee in 1953 called the Wisconsin Air Pageant with 21 planes. All moved to Oshkosh in 1970, a high-flying slice of Wisconsin. It's happening July 22nd to the 28th. I'm Terry Barr.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Matt and Air on Air.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I'm your host this hour and next hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Delighted and honored to have you with me on our weekend broadcast in our discussions of the intersection between the news, both national and international, and the rule of law, the delivery of justice, and in many ways, government in our nation and beyond. This major news story coming out early this past week, that the federal district court judge, her name is Eileen Cannon, who's presiding over this major prosecution brought by the U.S. Department of Justice through the Office of the Special Counsel involving the documents. These are the so-called Mar-a-Lago classified and sensitive documents. That's the predicate for the case brought against him, alleging both Donald Trump and two others also engaging in obstruction of justice in attempts to try to prevent the discovery of relevant information, to hide what they were doing when it comes to maintaining those records, keeping those records, storing those records, certainly at the Mar-a-Lago residence. We have seen the photographs of that and other evidence coming out of that case, also at Bedminster in New Jersey, and plainly documents taken from the White House in the final days and hours, perhaps, of the Donald Trump presidency. The federal judge, Eileen Cannon, just this past week, serving up a major, major rule of law decision in that case and finding that it has to be dismissed, gotten rid of. And in her docket entry at the end of her 93-page order, she makes very clear that she is done with this case. There is nothing more to deal with. She not only dismisses the case without prejudice, we're going to get back to that in just a moment or so. That's a significant aspect of this, but says that she is done with the case. No more hearings, no more pleadings, no more motions, no more hearings of any kind to try to address all the kinds of things that are still pending on that docket before the dismissal. She has directed the clerk of court to close out the case, and it is done. And again, the predicate for her doing that is not in the substance of it. She's not making findings about whether or not there was a substantive determination of whether Donald Trump did in fact do the things alleged in the multi-count indictment against him. That, of course, ultimately for the determination of a jury. She doesn't do that. She presides over the case, ultimately for a jury to decide, a jury that at least for now, she has indicated she is not going to preside over. She has done this instead on the finding, on the basis that the prosecutor himself, Jack Smith, the special counsel, appointed by the attorney general, was not properly appointed by the attorney general without authority, either statutory, something passed by the Congress, or in the Constitution. No basis for doing that under either of those doctrines, either of those theories, and therefore absent authority of the prosecution in the prosecution to do this, the entire case has to go away. Now, plainly, a major victory in the litigation for Donald Trump and for his defense counsel. They have raised this issue there, and as we have talked in other settings as well, the implications of this go far beyond just the Mar-a-Lago case, about which we will talk here on Amicus Law Review. Let's talk, however, about where this comes from and what the tendril is. What is the connection between what Eileen Cannon did this past week, getting rid of, removing from her docket, this major Mar-a-Lago documents case, and the United States Supreme Court? Well, it goes back to something that we have spent a lot of time talking about on this broadcast here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. You recall well that on July 1 of this year, the United States Supreme Court issued this major opinion. We've analyzed it in detail, provided you with a lot of information about what it says, what it doesn't say. We've talked about the dissenters who are aghast at what the Supreme Court has done. And what the Supreme Court has done is established that for some things, there are absolute, complete immunities that are vested in the executive branch, in the president, can't touch him, cannot prosecute the defendant, an executive defendant, for crimes committed in office, and for many other things, presumptions of immunity. And those relate to other things within the outer perimeter, as the Supreme Court says, of official duties. All of that we have talked about before. Along the way, in addition to that majority opinion that is joined in by six members of our Supreme Court, authored by the Chief Justice himself, his name is John Roberts. In addition to that, we made passing reference in the past to the 9-page concurrence, the additional piece that was added on, if you will, by another justice of the Supreme Court who agrees with the overall opinion of the majority, but nonetheless says, I would have come to that result in an easier, more direct way. And specifically, this is Clarence Thomas, who says at the outset and throughout his 9-page concurrence, it is not the law of the case, but nonetheless, his observation about how this could have been taken care of, he says it's difficult to see how the special counsel has an office established by law as required by the Constitution. Now, he's talking about the special counsel, Jack Smith, the same attorney who's prosecuting the Mar-a-Lago case, but he's talking about the prosecution against Donald Trump for election interference in the District of Columbia. Even so, he's talking about the same concept, the same person, the same entity, the same office that is prosecuting the Mar-a-Lago case. And in particular, let's review a bit of what Clarence Thomas said in his 9-page concurrence. He said the Constitution sets forth how an office may be created and how it may be filed. And it is important, he says, and it's important for all of us to focus on what is going on in South Florida, what's going on in this concurrence, by understanding, as Justice Thomas cites in his concurrence, the exact language of the Appointments Clause. It says this: the president shall nominate, and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, we hear that term a lot, that phrase a lot, shall appoint ambassadors and public ministers and consuls and judges of the Supreme Court and all other officers of the United States whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for and which shall be established by law. But the Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the president alone, in the courts of law, or in the heads of departments. That's the Appointments Clause of the U.S. Constitution. It is found in the second portion of Article 2 of the Constitution of the United States of America. Now, what is it that Justice Thomas finds so objectionable here? Well, he says, again, impossible to identify exactly how a special counsel has an office established by law as required by the Constitution. Goes on to say, when the Attorney General appointed the special counsel, he did not identify any statute that clearly creates such an office. So initially, again, the Associate Justice indicating there's no statutory authority to do this. Goes on to say this, nor did he rely on a statute granting him the authority to appoint officers as he deems fit, as the heads of some other agencies have. Instead, he says, the Attorney General relied upon several statutes of a very general nature, says none of those statutes cited by the Attorney General appears to create an office of the special counsel, and especially not with the clarity typical of past statutes used for that purpose. In the end, the Associate Justice, Clarence Thomas, says, because of the constitutional infirmity, because there's no statutory basis for any of that, what has to happen here is that the lower courts need to take a look at all of this in determining whether or not there's a basis for the special counsel to do what indeed he's doing in that case. Why is that relevant? As we come back, we're going to talk about what Eileen Cannon did in picking up on that language and choosing to dismiss the case coming out of the Southern District of Florida.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
ABC News, I'm Derek Dennis. On the campaign trail, former President Trump appearing with his newly announced Republican running mate J.D. Vance later today in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Trump's first campaign rally since his assassination attempt.
A source with knowledge of the investigation telling ABC News about the searches found on the gunman's phone. The date of Trump's rally, major depressive disorder, the Democratic National Convention, and bomb making. Images of FBI Director Christopher Wray, Attorney General Merrick Garland, and other public figures found on the phone as well.
ABC's Phil Lipoff. Meantime, there's mounting pressure on President Biden, facing growing calls to drop out of the race from fellow Democrats, donors, and others who don't think he's up to the fight. Sources tell ABC News Biden is now open to discussions over dropping out. And chaos and frustration at airports worldwide after Friday's massive cybersecurity outage caused by a software glitch from the global IT company CrowdStrike. Check your airline. Travel is still a mess. This is ABC.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Brewers baseball is back. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Milwaukee Brewers back in action after having the week off for the All-Star game. They're in Minnesota to face off against the Twins. The Brewers still in first place with a 4.5 game lead over the Cardinals, but Milwaukee has lost 7 of their last 10 games. Brewers manager Pat Murphy.
I think we're at a stage these last couple weeks where guys are, you know, no matter how much we talk about it, guys are like looking for the break and think we're a little disconnected, to be quite honest. And there's been some guys coming back from injuries, some new guys playing. It seems like things have kind of went against us. But this is the lull in the action that happens in any season. And you can't flinch, but you also can't say we're not going to do anything. You got to be realistic. Other teams came in and played with a little freedom. We aren't playing with any freedom at all.
Basketball, the Bucks lost to the Phoenix Suns 115-90. Milwaukee now 0-4 in the NBA Summer League action. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Northern Wisconsin weather. I'm Corey Hartman. For today, a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Otherwise, mostly cloudy with highs in the upper 70s. For tonight, slight chance of a storm that comes to an end. We'll have mostly cloudy skies and a low around 55. Sunshine for Sunday with a high around 78.
It's 64 at our studios.
This is a special announcement from Civic Media. Civic Media believes that violence has no place in the political process and stands in stark opposition to the principles of democracy. It stifles constructive dialogue, compromises the integrity of democratic institutions, and threatens the safety of individuals and communities. Democracy thrives on peaceful discourse, mutual respect, and adherence to the rule of law. It's crucial to engage with differing viewpoints respectfully and to avoid the temptation to vilify political opposition. Such vilification only deepens divisions and hampers the collaborative spirit necessary for effective governance. We, both individuals and media organizations, must reaffirm our commitment to the principles of democracy by fostering an environment where ideas can be exchanged peacefully and constructively. By doing so, we allow for a just, inclusive, and democratic society for all.
The Todd Albaugh Show.
Andrew Klon, he is a data journalist, and he maps out in this article what makes Wisconsin great. 96% of Wisconsinites live within 30 minutes of Quick Trip.
Wisconsin is one of those places that has a cultural identity that's unique to this place. And when we tell stories like this, it reminds people that we all come from this place and we all share a goal, genuinely, of trying to make this state a better place.
The Todd Albaugh Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Matt Nair on air.
John Ellingson is our guest. He's one of the co-directors of the Eau Claire Cube League.
It's a Swedish yard game. You would toss a baton trying to knock down your opponent's cubes.
You have teams from all over the country. What are some of the other names that stuck out to you?
Cube Hand Luke.
Nice. Yeah.
The Salty Batons.
Oh. Do you call the last 16 teams the Swedish 16?
Oh, I'm writing that down. That's pretty good.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on
Todd
the Albaugh.
Hey everybody, join us next time as we'll catch you up on news of the weekend and also the current status of the Democratic nominee Joe Biden. Not going to want to miss it. Be there.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We are talking in this, our first hour of our weekend broadcast, all about the transition between this concurrence written by Clarence Thomas and the decision of just this past week issued by Federal District Court Judge Eileen Cannon dismissing the so-called Mar-a-Lago documents case. Near the conclusion of his opinion in that concurrence in the Trump versus United States case, Clarence Thomas says, these are serious questions I'm raising about the statutory and constitutional authority of the special counsel to prosecute this case. He says those questions must be answered before the prosecution can proceed, and then invites this. He says the lower courts should answer these essential questions. Indeed, that's exactly what Eileen Cannon picks up, and that's exactly what, at least from her perspective, she does. Again, in this major decision, 93 pages, she says that there's no federal statute, there's no constitutional basis for the special counsel's prosecution of the case, mirroring almost completely exactly what Clarence Thomas has said in his concurring opinion. He did it in 9 pages. She did it in 93. Interestingly, somewhat lost in some of the media coverage on this, she also finds that Jack Smith had been improperly funded by the Treasury Department, and therefore there was an appropriations clause problem with this as well. So we've got two issues, principally the appointments clause, but also the appropriations clause. And of course, all of this comes in the midst of what was once identified as one of the most straightforward of the four criminal prosecutions against Donald Trump as they've been brought by both federal and state officials. He is charged once again in this case with illegally holding on to these classified national security materials after leaving office. That a source of no small concern, a national security concern about who else has seen these documents, who else had access to them at Mar-a-Lago, maybe in New Jersey as well, other places, raising issues not just about the paper movement, but about threats to our national security. And that's why this case has been and remains so very important. And along the way, after the initial indictment was returned by the grand jury, finding probable cause to believe that indeed those crimes had been committed, grand jury returns and says, we're going to add some obstruction of justice charges to this as well. In the efforts to retrieve some of the information there, obstruction of justice alleged against Donald Trump and against two co-defendants, two of his workers there. Remember their names, Walt Nauta and Carlos de Oliveira. Both of them, also defendants in this case, also dismissed by virtue of Eileen Cannon's omnibus dismissal order of just this past week. Special counsel Jack Smith, of course, responds, and he says this. He says the dismissal of his case deviates from the uniform conclusion of all previous courts to have considered the issue that the attorney general is statutorily authorized to appoint a special counsel, and the Justice Department is authorized a special counsel to appeal that court's order. Indeed, that's exactly what Jack Smith has done following the issuance of this order, bringing to an end, at least for now, the progress of this case in front of Judge Eileen Cannon. He has appealed this decision to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. That is the Court of Appeals directly above the district courts in the 11th Circuit, including South Florida. This is the same court that on at least two occasions in the past has reversed, has rejected positions articulated by Eileen Cannon when it came to that civil attack on the conduct of the criminal investigation that preceded all of this. Now, all of that's very wonky. All of that's a lot to consume. But the bottom line is the 11th Circuit has already on two previous occasions told Eileen Cannon that she is wrong and reversed her and told her she's got to reinstitute not only the proper adjudication of justice, which in that previous case meant hands off when it comes to attempting to oversee the investigation. Now she's shut down the actual prosecution. We'll see what the 11th Circuit does. Highly likely, the 11th Circuit will follow what the Supreme Court has said and what all these other courts have previously said in deciding that special counsels and special prosecutors are in fact constitutional. In that 93-page order that is now on appeal to the 11th Circuit, by far the longest writing that she has issued since she has been handling this documents case for about a year or so. She offers what is admittedly an in-depth look at her legal reasons for tossing out the charges. At the heart of her thinking, again, was this assertion articulated by Clarence Thomas, articulated at much greater length by her in her exposition, that there's no specific federal statute that authorized the appointment of special counsels or gives them the prosecutorial power that they have wielded for almost a quarter century. Nothing constitutional either. Now, just as a way of some background here, special counsels are currently governed by Justice Department regulations that for a long period of time have been supported by federal laws that lay out the structure of the department and the specific powers of the Attorney General. All of that has been established at least since 1999 when the Congress, the statutory authority here coming from Congress, establishes something called the Independent Counsel Act. And that at the time authorized, governed a different type of independent prosecutor. And that was at the time of the so-called Whitewater investigation into Bill Clinton's matters, not only with respect to Whitewater, but also ultimately Monica Lewinsky. Judge Cannon basically took a wrecking ball, if you will, to all of that and said that none of that is supported by the Constitution or by the statutory authority here. She declared that allowing special counsels to operate under the control of the Attorney General was a violation of separation of powers. And she invites in this way, language I will read from the order, invites Congress to pass a new law if indeed you think that Mr. Smith should continue to pursue this and other cases against Donald Trump. She says this: if the political branches wish to grant the Attorney General power to appoint Special Counsel Smith to investigate and prosecute this action with the full powers of a United States attorney, there's a valid means by which to do so. Now, all of that sounds good perhaps on the surface, but for the fact that it is simply wrong. And not only is there statutory authority, but it has been affirmed by the Supreme Court repeatedly in recent years, in addition to this appropriations, this funding issue, also a matter of review by previous courts. The judge in this case appears to agree with this argument that drawing funds from the Treasury without statutory authorization, good reason to believe that the appropriations clause violation here also happened. That's a separate independent basis. And of course, all of that comes together at a time when, as a result of this, the case now dismissed in front of her. Now, Justice Thomas never mentioned Judge Cannon in his concurrence, but he did recommend, once again, the lower courts take a look at that, and that is exactly what Judge Cannon has now done. The reality is that there's a great deal of history on this, as I've indicated, supported by the Supreme Court and other lower courts that have affirmed the capacity of the Attorney General to do just this. They've included the Supreme Court way back in a case called United States versus Nixon, 1974. Supreme Court upholding the appointment of a fellow named Leon Jaworski. Many of you may remember him. He was investigating Watergate, the obstruction of justice events at those times. And interestingly, United States versus Nixon, 1974, a unanimous court, 9-0, written by the Chief Justice. His name is Warren Burger. Warren Burger, writing for a unanimous court, says two things. One is, he says there's no such thing as executive immunity. That doesn't exist. That doesn't exist, United States versus Nixon, 1974. And he also goes on to say that while we focus principally on this notion, dismissed, that there is executive privilege, there's executive immunity, the reality is that there is, in fact, constitutional capacity for the special prosecutor at that time, again, Leon Jaworski, to investigate, finding expressly in United States versus Nixon precedent for decades that this kind of thing can, in fact, be done. And it goes on. During the course of the subsequent years, we know well that that same notion, gotten different names, special prosecutor, special counsel, it has changed over time as the Congress has tried to wrestle with this issue of authority and how exactly a special counsel, a special prosecutor is to operate inside the Department of Justice, and yet with sufficient integrity and apartness from the Attorney General to ensure the American public has confidence in that process. As the courts have gone along, they've reaffirmed this basic notion that you can, in fact, have special prosecutors and special counsel. They did it in the investigations involving President Ronald Reagan. Remember the Iran-Contra scandal? Same thing affirmed there. President Bill Clinton, as I just said, in the Whitewater-Monica Lewinsky scandal. Same kind of thing. President Donald Trump in the Russia 2020 campaign interference investigation. All of those, special counsel, special prosecutors, all of them affirmed by the courts, overruling and finding expressly, as did the Supreme Court, that Congress has indeed, contrary to what Eileen Cannon says, and yes, what Justice Clarence Thomas says, Congress has vested in the Attorney General both the power to conduct criminal litigation of the United States, and here we go, to appoint subordinate officers to assist in the discharge of those duties. The statutory authority is there. The constitutional authority is there. The Supreme Court has said so. Other courts have addressed this. And indeed, those same principles also animate recent investigations. We know them well. Right now, the investigations of Hunter Biden, who was recently convicted in that firearms case in Delaware. He is going to be sentenced sometime soon. He's also awaiting trial in a tax matter out in California. Those cases also being prosecuted, again, inside the Department of Justice, but by special counsel. In that case, a fellow named David Weiss. Those prosecutions also supported by all of this precedent, and indeed also precedent for the investigation of President Joe Biden. He was investigated, remember this, for possessing government documents, a finding by Robert Hur, the special counsel in that case, also justified in that investigation judicially, and finding in the end that there's no basis upon which to pursue an investigation of the president for that, finding in the end that there would not be charges against him. All of those recent cases being brought by, being investigated by, being pursued by special counsels pursuant to the clear statements by the Supreme Court that this is permissible, contrary to the express opinions issued by Eileen Cannon and by Clarence Thomas. And so what happens in the wake of the clarity of all of this and the wrongness of the decision issued by Eileen Cannon, seizing on this one issue and getting rid of everything else? Well, we know what's happened once again. We know that Jack Smith has already appealed this decision to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, bringing this up and certainly going to be arguing in the months ahead based upon briefs and oral arguments to the 11th Circuit, a three-judge panel there asking once again that the 11th Circuit reverse Judge Cannon, as they have done on two previous instances, telling Judge Cannon once again that she is wrong and asking that this case be reinstated based upon the fact that her bases for dismissing the case are not well-founded, are not consistent with precedent, and are inconsistent with the law as established by the Supreme Tribunal in our country, the United States Supreme Court. He has done that. And sometime in the next several months, the appeals court presumably will entertain those arguments, both written and oral, and decide on that issue, almost certainly going to say that indeed Eileen Cannon is wrong, and implicitly, that Clarence Thomas is also wrong. Note in his concurrence, nobody else on the Supreme Court joins him in that view. Nobody else agrees with Clarence Thomas on this issue. Likely to assume that nobody else agrees with Eileen Cannon on this either. Now, there are a couple of other remedies that Jack Smith could consider, and he certainly has, no doubt, inside the Department of Justice, thinking about what do you do in the wake of the dismissal of this very important national security case. How do you remedy this matter brought on by a judge who is engaging in what many have called a lawless decision? Two of the things that he plainly can do, one of them, of course, he could ask the 11th Circuit to seek her recusal, ask them to remove her from the future pendency of this case. Let us assume that at some point down the road, the Supreme Court does indeed reinstate this. He could also ask that she be taken off the case. He hasn't done that up to now. That's an option. As Amicus Law Review continues, I'm going to tell you about another option that's out there for the special counsel as he addresses this decision by the district court in South Florida.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected to your local community. Here's Terry Barr with the Civic Media Radio Network.
It's entertaining. It's competitive. It's the Lumberjack World Championships in Hayward. Cheer on amateurs, semi-pro, and professionals at the Lumberjack Bowl on August 1st through the 3rd. Find a schedule at lumberjackworldchampionships.com. Also in Hayward, hop aboard a vintage trolley to learn about the city's colorful past and present. Four tours available Friday, August 2nd. Visit the Sawyer County Historical Society for details and registration. Over to Amory, and Friday night, August 2nd, it's the Revved Up Dance Party happening at the Mix-Up. Fun venue with great music starting at 6 p.m. And celebrate the 71st anniversary of Flamborama, described as Park Falls' longest hometown gathering. Event planners say it's going to be bigger and better than ever. Save the dates to join the fun of Flamborama, August 2nd through the 4th. Enjoy, and until next time, I'm Terry Barr.
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
Solar Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host this hour and also next hour, when we talk about the Supreme Court and lower courts in our nation, talking right now about this major decision by Eileen Cannon to dismiss the documents case, one of those four criminal prosecutions proceeding against Donald Trump, who is now the nominee of the Republican Party to become the president of the United States of America. Another option that is out there for Jack Smith, that all the prosecutors certainly identified. He is apparently not going to pursue this. It's not clear whether he's going to ask the 11th Circuit to recuse Judge Cannon, assuming that it sends this case back to the district court, reinstates it. Not clear that he's going to ask that she be taken off this case, although that is certainly an option that is before him. Maybe the 11th Circuit would be interested in at least considering that. Hasn't done so yet, at least not publicly in pleadings. But there's another option that apparently he is not going to pursue, and that is simply to reindict. That is simply to go back to a grand jury, a new grand jury, as they did in this case, and present the evidence again to that grand jury. No problem here. No problem at all with double jeopardy. Jeopardy is not attached. Nothing about this violates the Constitution. To go back to a grand jury and say, we're presenting this evidence anew. We're asking you to determine whether there's probable cause, and do that. Do all of that, not through a special counsel, but have the Attorney General or someone in the criminal division address the very issue that Eileen Cannon has apparently identified as being problematic. If you don't like the special counsel, Judge Cannon, we'll do it another way. We'll do it the way that 90%, 99% of all the cases in America are prosecuted. What we're going to do is we are going to assign this to someone, a trial attorney in the Department of Justice, no special counsel, no special title, no special prosecutor, an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of Florida, in the District of Columbia, maybe in New Jersey, a trial attorney in the criminal division, the public integrity section of Maine Justice, a mainline prosecutor, a civil servant there for a long time with this experience, no special counsel appellation, no special counsel designation. We'll do this as we normally do. Have that attorney prosecute the case. We get out from under this problem that you've identified, Eileen Cannon, inappropriately, wrongly, as being problematic. But we can pursue it in that way and get this done as well, alleging virtually the same crimes as before and reinstituting this case. Addressing, if you will, the problem the judiciary has identified, at least these two, a justice and a district court judge, and getting this case back on track. And the advocacy to do that, of course, would be nothing wrong with doing that constitutionally or statutorily. But it's a strategic decision that Jack Smith can, in fact, make if he wants to do that. He has chosen to go down the appellate road almost certainly longer in duration, unlikely, almost impossible to believe that under either path, this case will go to trial. The appellate route going to require, again, oral arguments and motions and memorandums, a decision probably in 2025. You go the other route, a reindictment of the charges, as a grand jury may, in its discretion, determine to do. That process can go forward in the next weeks and months and return to the docket, whether it is in South Florida, in the District of Columbia, all places where there is what's called venue, the possibility of bringing this case. The best one is probably South Florida, where most of the documents were found, discovered, retained. But we also have a tendril there in Washington, D.C., where the documents were taken out of the White House. There's certainly an indication there's something going on in New Jersey. Some of the documents were there as well. You've got venue in a number of different spots. You could consider that. But you can also consider doing this again, assigning it to an assistant U.S. attorney in South Florida and saying, prosecute this case and go ahead and restart this process, get the arraignment underway, get the motion practice underway. Whether it's assigned to Eileen Cannon or another judge, that is a matter of, again, of course, for judicial administration. That is another remedy that is out there. We will see how all this plays out, continue to report on it, and describe further what happens in the wake of this momentous decision, a decision by Eileen Cannon that virtually everybody on all sides of the political aisle and all sides of the legal aisle, if you will, all ideologies look at this and say, this is cannot and will not stand. We will see what the 11th Circuit does. Unlikely the Supreme Court is going to embrace this notion either. We do know that in the wake of all of this, that this has caught the attention of the President of the United States of America as well. And in particular, although he has not announced it with great clarity, President Joe Biden has indicated that he is going to make some proposals, both statutory and legislative, to address what he has identified as a number of different concerns and challenges, out-and-out problems that many of us, including the president, and people, again, on all sides of political aisles have identified with respect to the management, the administration of justice, and even the behavior of the justices on the Supreme Court. The president said just this past week that he has been working with constitutional scholars for the last 3 months on a package of reforms that will affect the work, the conduct of the Supreme Court. And he said, I need some help. He said, I'm going to need your help. And he's talking to the American public, your help on the Supreme Court. Because he said, I'm about to come out with some proposals that have been under consideration. He says, I don't want to prematurely announce it, but I'm about to come out with a major initiative on limiting the court and what we do. A major initiative limiting the court on what we can do. Presumably based upon all the indications, he may in fact be calling for a constitutional amendment that could limit this broad presidential immunity that the court's conservative majority has just issued as of July 1. That's a big lift. That is a big lift. And that may be a part of his package. And it may, in fact, be a part of what he's going to propose. Of course, the president has also described this immunity package, the immunity issue, rather, the decision as being a dangerous precedent and that there are virtually no limits on what a president can do. An amendment, however, to the Constitution, as we all know well, would presumably face even greater challenges. It would require 2/3 votes in Congress and presumably ratification by 3/4 of the state legislatures as well. That's no small thing, but it underscores the focus that the president has in rejecting the powers that have been given to him by the Supreme Court, establishing a kingdom, if you will, in the presidency, as many have said. He's rejecting that and also saying we need a constitutional amendment to overcome what the Supreme Court did in this recent case, United States versus Trump. In our next hour, I'm going to tell you more about this package of things the current president's proposing, including likely issues related to term limits and also an enforceable code of ethics. Term limits, and also a code of ethics on the justices. All of that coming up in our second hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
Pat Kreitlow. Monday morning, Trygve Olson from the Lincoln Project gives a convention review from Republicans hoping to reclaim their party someday from Trump extremists.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings starting at 6. Keep your home comfortable with a new Hunter ceiling fan from Menards. We carry the largest selection of in-stock Hunter ceiling fans available in a variety of designs, finishes, and features. Create the perfect look for any room with a Hunter ceiling fan. Save big on Hunter ceiling fans at Menards, America's number one home improvement retailer for customer satisfaction, according to J.D. Power. For J.D. Power 2024 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards.
Save big money at Menards.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
This is the Buzz of the North, WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.